Think of it as a little bit of Old Home Week. Today on Piled High and Deep, the podcast, as I'm returning with a new episode after a couple of weeks off. More like eight. Well, anyway, Rochelle Dalla and I went to high school together in the small town of Durango, Colorado. It's down in the southwest corner of the state. Rochelle graduated a year after me, and it wasn't until we connected on Facebook and, well, this might sound a little creepy, what is Rochelle up to? And found out she's a doctorate, and she teaches at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Well, I also found out during our interview that she was at the University of Colorado at the same time as I. But the difference was she was a little bit more focused on studying. Maybe that's why I'm talking to her now as Dr. Dalla. She's fresh off of a trip in India where she's been studying human trafficking. Well, now, Rochelle didn't plan this path. Some might call it a little bit haphazard. I say Rochelle has the ability to make the most out of the opportunities presenting themselves to her at any given moment. And because she didn't have a plan, she was open to lots of possibilities. And it's this openness to possibilities that put her on the road to graduate school. And it was the attitude in graduate school that led her to the Navajo Reservation, where she talked with young women who found themselves unexpectedly being young mothers.
And when I'm leaving the reservation, it occurred to me that their heartaches was publishable, right? This was going to be good stuff. People are going to want to read this. And I now have a responsibility to them. And that's, I think, where the change in my brain happened, is that this is serious stuff. And this is people's lives. And their stories are opening doors for me.
And that door that opened for her was there in Lincoln, Nebraska. Now, that's quite the culture shock coming from Arizona and before that, the mountains of Colorado and Boulder, Colorado. But it was a chance conversation with a student where she found that next focus. And it's a focus that continues her work today. She talks to women in the sex trade all around the world. Now, it's tough duty and one that Rochelle takes so seriously. She decided to get an additional degree in mental health counseling because she knew something important was missing in her research.
One of my strengths is that I was really interested in these women's lives and their heartaches and their pains. And that, I was really genuine. I still am really genuine in that. But I really just wanted to know more, too, about what could actually be done to help individuals who are in basically a constant state of crises. So mental health is one thing, but housing and legal assistance and their kids are in, and domestic violence, they've had so much going on, is what would be useful for them, right? So really from multiple perspectives, but the motivation to do this was really just to be better at my job.
I'm not certain of the PhDs that I've talked to who might have a tougher job. She talks to women who are seemingly in a constant state of trauma and crisis. It's a heck of a journey that we have today on Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Well, thanks for coming back and downloading and listening to the podcast. I know it's been a couple of months since I've had a fresh episode up. Been trying to figure out what it is that I want to do with this. Well, I just decided let's get back to what I'm having fun doing, and we'll worry about the rest of it at another time. If you'd like, you can follow me on Twitter at themountaingeek.net. The podcast Twitter handle is PhD the podcast. Also, you can follow me on my blog, and the website for the podcast is themountaingeek.net. Rochelle Dalla, thank you so much for taking time for and speaking to me a couple of Sundays ago. She stopped over on her way from Lincoln back to the homestead in Durango, Colorado. I hope you enjoy this. It was quite the journey that Rochelle has been on. And I think my biggest takeaway from here is that if you don't have a plan, that can be really great because that means you're going to be opened up to a whole bunch of different possibilities in your life. So enough of me. Let's start shoveling with Dr. Rochelle Dalla.
At what point did you make the decision to get your PhD?
I'll tell you, I was really, really naive about everything. And I made the decision to get the PhD when I got accepted into a doctoral program. I mean, that's the truth. So when I graduated from college, let's back up. So about a year before I graduated from college, I was getting a bachelor's degree in psychology. And I was feeling really good about that and thinking I'm almost done, yay. And then it occurred to me, seriously, I'm like a senior getting ready to graduate, that I can't do anything with a bachelor's degree in psychology. What am I going to do? Go back to Durango and then, you know, do what? So it was like, wow, I need to get more education. And so then I started applying to programs. And I was just applying to anybody that would accept me because I had no idea what I wanted to do. But I just knew that more education would at least open more doors. And I didn't even, Ted, know the difference between really what I could do with a master's versus a PhD. Just really naive. And I ended up getting accepted into a comprehensive doctoral program, which basically means you get accepted as a bachelor's degree student, but the assumption is that you're going to go until you get your PhD. And so that's basically when I decided I was getting my PhD.
Now I think what's interesting about this conversation you and I are about to embark on is that we do have some shared growing up experiences, yeah. Both coming from Durango.
Yeah.
And a high school experience that, at least for me, I was not identified as a college-bound kid, but I was also kind of stuck in that middle where, at the time, our high school still had a fairly decent vocational programs, but I wasn't going down that path. I could have easily have gotten into the local college, Fort Lewis. I knew that I needed to get out of town, but I also had this dream that I was always, there was no doubt I was going to go to the University of Colorado. That was just going to happen. Now, my parents always expected mm-hmm. college. Mm-hmm. Did you have the same thing? Did your parents, was that kind of the expectation hammered into your head?
So I wouldn't say that it was really hammered in, but the expectation was there, especially really from my dad. He was, you know, wanted to be successful and wanted me to be successful. And for him, that meant a really good degree, get a college degree, get an education, whatever. For my mom, it was more like, do what makes you happy. And if that means going to college and figuring out, then that's fine. But like you, I needed out of Durango for perspective. And so I didn't even apply to Fort Lewis. And
yeah, I didn't either.
Going to University of Colorado Boulder was like the pinnacle. It was like that would be. And it was really more because of the reputation and not because of the academics, really. It was really just, I want to get into Boulder because that'd be a cool place to go. And so that's where I went.
Were you a good student in high school? I was not.
I was, no, the truth, I wasn't. I wasn't really into school. I was more into friends and, you know, unfortunately some, you know, just risk-taking behavior and cliques and all of that. I was not thinking about academics and I love this and this is what I'm going to do. No, that was not at all where I was. And actually, one of the aha moments came to me. I was listening to your interview with Elizabeth and she was talking about some aha moments. And one of mine was when I got my first grade report back. It was, you know, the semester grades at Boulder, and I had straight A's. And I remember I was sitting in the cafeteria looking at this. And I'm like, whoa, okay, so I can do this. I'm not half, you know, I'm halfway smart. So if I apply myself, I can really do well at this. So that was an aha moment for me.
Did you have a college experience that was enjoyable?
No, I wouldn't say it was enjoyable. So my college experience, my dad paid for it, and I'll just say that, like, we come from, like, hard-working people, but pretty self-made, and my dad paid for it. I didn't have to get a job, and I felt like this, I owe it to him to do my very best, right? Like, I'm here for a degree. I'm here for really good grades, and he's paying for it. So I focus entirely on this. So I was not really involved with friends. I mean, I'm in Boulder, right? This is a beautiful place, and I really didn't do anything but study. And really just, I think, probably to prove to myself that I could and to make my father proud, but not for some long-term goal beyond that. I was not, I'm going to tell you again, I was pretty naive, okay? It wasn't like I'm doing this to go for that job at all. The only thing I didn't want to do was go back to Durango and be, you know, a maid again or something like that, right?
Okay, so I'm going to jump ahead here quick, and then we're going to go back. What is it that you do right now?
So right now I am a professor. So I'm a professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. It's in the Department of Child, Youth, and Family Studies. And UNL, I've been there for 21 years now. And so I teach. I teach undergraduate courses. I teach graduate courses. And I do a lot of research. I'm the editor of a journal. I founded a journal. I'm the editor of a journal. I'm really proud about that. And I love being a professor, but this is not the path that I sort of picked out for myself.
Okay, so we're going to go back now.
We can jump.
We're going to jump right there. That's what conversations are.
You know, I'll say one more thing is that when I was at Boulder, because it was known then, I don't know, I'm assuming it's probably still known as very much a party school, and I really took a lot of pride in the fact that I would be home like on a Friday night and a Saturday night, not home, in the dorms, because I lived in the dorms, studying instead of doing anything. And I really didn't make friends in college. Like, I was there to study, and that was pretty much it, to be honest with you.
You're saying that you had this goal that you wanted to make sure that your father was proud because you didn't...
And grades was how to do it.
And grades was how to do it. Did you have other family influences that you maybe were trying to make sure that you didn't duplicate?
So two other family influences. One was my sister, and that was huge. And it was, I don't know what I'm going to do, but if I do anything that looks like something she would do, then I'm changing course. So that was one. And then my mom was always in the back of my mind, like, Rochelle, you don't have to study so hard. You don't have to, you know, can you add some more balance to your life and be happy? And so that was there too. And I actually remember something that she asked me one time, and she said, are you doing this for you, or are you doing it for your father, right, in terms of just the amount of time I was spending studying? And I was like, well, I don't know who I am right now, so as long as I'm doing this and it's going to lead somewhere eventually, then that's what I'm going to stick with. My sister is another kind of story. My sister was really, I would characterize her as kind of just all in high school and everything, and really into I would say drugs and just law breaking. And she was 2 years older than me, and we grew up in a town where people know people, and I really wanted to disidentify with that. I didn't want people to think of, to hear the name and think of her and assume that I was like that. And so I really, really didn't know what I was going to do, but I wanted it to be the opposite of that. And part of that too was like, I just have a lot of commitment to my parents and not wanting people to just assume we were a bad family because Andrea was so, you know, just, I mean, she really got into a ton of trouble and dropped out of high school and drugs and, you know, just on and on and on. And I wanted it to be clear that it wasn't because of entirely.
You needed to delineate between the two of you.
Yeah, I needed to delineate between the two of us, but I also needed to delineate between this wasn't just parental influences, right? That she did a lot on her own, and these parents could actually raise a good kid too. So that was a lot of just at least those early years and just trying to figure, I don't know what I want to do, but I know I don't want to do that. And, okay, grades seem like
the way to do it.
The way to go, yeah.
I did look at your CV. Mm-hmm. You have two undergrad, though. Don't you have an anthropology in there, too?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what I was doing is I was doing psychology, and I loved it. And I just needed a couple, you know, I was just, in terms of electives, started taking some anthro courses, loved them. And then by the time I went and saw my advisor, I'm like, well, if I just do a couple of more, then I'll have another degree. And so that's why then I went with that path. And I actually now identify a lot. Anthropologists do some phenomenal work and research. And I'm really kind of like an anthropologist as well as a family scientist, to be honest with you. But that was not by design. Again, not pretty much nothing was by design. It was really just take some more classes and you'll get another degree in anthro as well.
Did you do it in 4 years?
I did. Well, yeah. I mean, I was doing nothing but studying. That's all I did. I tell my students now, do not do what I did. Have some balance in your life. Enjoy it. I wish I would have enjoyed it a
little more. Yeah, okay. So let's talk about that. In your position as a professor, you're a teaching professor, a researcher as well. You work with undergrads, graduates. What do you, we had talked earlier before I turned the mic on, we don't want to, with our kids, we want to make sure that we're not imposing ideals upon our children based on our previous experiences. But I think that that's a little different when you're coming from it as a professor, making sure that you're sharing you want your kids, your college kids, to have a more well-rounded experience in college.
Right.
What are some of the goals that you set out for them or recommend to them when you see them potentially going down or wanting to go down a similar path that you are?
What I tell my students, so I teach a variety of different undergraduate, graduate courses in the classroom, online. One class is, and I will get to this, I'm going to do it in a roundabout way, but one of them, it's a 200-level class, and I get students, there are about 150 students in there, and I do talk to them. The first thing that I do is I just tell them, if anyone at this level wants to talk to me about graduate school, come and see me one-on-one. And I tell them that I had no idea what graduate school was until I was a senior. Don't do what I did, right? So I really try and get the idea set in their head that it's not too early to think about it. There is money available, so if money is what's stopping you, you can do that. And then to really just be very I think deliberate in thinking about what they want to do, not doing what I did, which is just kind of go through and hope things work out. And guess what? They did for me, but let's not chance it with your life, is kind of what I do with my undergraduate students.
Did you have any undergrad experiences from a professor, instructor? Do you have any relationships there that you still hold on to?
No.
Or was there anybody that was directly impactful?
No, not really. There was I really liked my psych faculty and the anthro ones as well. But it was really a student that I met in a class, and she was, probably junior, senior, just like me. And we just became kind of friends. And she was telling me that she was applying to graduate schools and going on these interviews. And I'm like, what in the world? Really? And that had the biggest impact, because then I started to seek out, and it's like, okay, so what do I need to do? What do I need to do now? What's all this about? But there really wasn't a particular, actually, there was one that was so phenomenal in the classroom just as a teacher that I'm like, wow. And that really sort of opened my eyes to different ways of teaching and how teaching could actually really be a lot of fun. So I got that, and I got that this guy was super motivated and he loved what he did. But there was really no one that sort of took me under their wings or anything like that. No, not as an undergrad. Mm-mm.
Which is the next step then. How do you end up in Arizona?
So this one student that I told you, about the same time, actually, and it was probably conversations with her that made me realize that I needed more education, and that going to Durango with a bachelor's in psych was really not going to open a whole lot of doors for me. And so then I started applying to grad schools. And the truth, Ted, is that the only graduate schools I applied to were those like within a geographic area because I didn't want to be too far away from Durango, right? I wanted to be close to family. And so I applied to quite a few. And the problem now, as a faculty member who now reviews graduate applications, I understand very well that the problem with my applications was that I did not know what I wanted to do, and that comes through in those applications. I mean, it really comes through. And so I was in psych undergrad, and I thought, okay, I'll just go into clinical psych, right? I mean, I didn't know anything else, really naive. So I was applying to all these clinical psych programs and really getting not accepted at most of them. I got accepted at one sort of tentatively, but really not a lot. And then what happened was in Arizona, and I applied in Arizona because it was close, but also because it was warm, and I really was tired of the cold of Durango. And this is true. I mean, I'm just being totally honest. I'm like, I would love to live in Tucson where it's just warm and I can be away from snow for a while. And I applied to a clinical psych program. This is what happened. Again, I didn't choose the path. The path chose me. I got this letter saying, okay, you're not accepted into the clinical psych program. However, what happened is that there was a new doctoral program in human development and family studies. It was like 5 years old. And they were still trying to attract people to their program because it was such a new program. And so they were looking at files in related areas. They saw my file and said, well, would you be interested in human development and family studies instead of clinical psych? And I'm like, what is that? I didn't even know that existed. That sounds cool. Sure. Seriously, sure. And it was a comprehensive doctoral program. And basically, I had to send them a couple more things, but then they accepted me. So right after I left Boulder, at like age, 20, 21, moved straight to Tucson and started this comprehensive doctoral program. I mean, that's... Did that answer your
question? Yeah, absolutely, because... I haven't found any PhD. You know, there aren't.
Who are so naive?
No. It's not about naivete. It's about truly understanding what the opportunities are around us. And you know, if you're lucky enough, I've talked to some who have been lucky enough to be influenced very early on by a professor during their undergrad, whether they're taking a science lab or they spend a little extra time in an office asking questions. Yeah. But for your path, my question is, you're lucky enough, somebody found your application. And I'm sure that this combination of psychology with an understanding of anthropology clicks in someone's brain to give them the idea that this is somebody who has the potential for it. Who was that person? Do you know?
I don't know. And I don't know. And here's the great part, too, is that not only were they accepting me, and they were only accepting 5 students a year, so it was really small. I think what worked in my favor is that there weren't a lot of people applying to them at the time because it was such a new program. Because my application, to be honest with you, Ted, was not very strong. It just wasn't that strong, but maybe it was a combination. Not only did I get accepted into this program, but I also got an assistantship, which I don't know if you realize how rare those are. So, I mean, you really have, at least they've become incredibly competitive. And so I also got an assistantship so that I was able to pay in-state instead of out-of-state tuition. Financially, it just made sense. Then when I got there, I ended up with, and this person had a tremendous influence on me when I was in graduate school. She was my advisor. I got signed up with her because every day, I mean, I walked in there realizing how little I knew just about the world. I mean, just going up in Durango, having very little work experience, and just basically following a path that was kind of laid out for me, not me having a lot of agency. And every day, I wouldn't say every day, but there was this constant question of, should I, first of all, should I really be here? I mean, I don't have the extent of life experiences that other, I mean, I'm like 20 with doctoral students who'd worked and been involved in all kinds of things. And so I was really questioning my own ability to be there, my own competence. And not only that, what am I going to do with this? Because it still wasn't clear to me. What in the world am I going to do with a PhD? But it was really just, okay, go through and things will turn out. Things will be okay. I don't have a better plan right now, so let's just stick with it.
So the naivete actually works to your advantage.
It worked to my advantage. I'm sure it did. Well, and I'll tell you how it also worked to my advantage, because I was terrified to talk in front of groups. I mean, terrified. And writing, I'd had an experience as an undergrad that basically told me that my writing was really bad. And now all I do is write and talk in front of groups. So if someone would have told me my first year, my second year in this doctoral program, that that's what I was being trained to do, I probably would have dropped out.
What was your first publication?
My first publication, you know, the first one where I was the lead author was on my dissertation work. Okay. On the Navajo Reservation.
All right. So I don't want to jump ahead to that then. What had been then your experiences leading up to that, leading up to your dissertation in graduate school? When did you find the love for writing? Or maybe not a love for, at least a like for and an appreciation of?
I'll tell you that, again, my mentor in graduate school, her name was Wendy Gamble, and just I think the way that she mentored, first of all, she had a really balanced life as a professor. She had kids. She did fun things with them. She didn't get too worked up over stuff at school. But the way that she mentored is that she gave a lot of independence to her students, and she just had a sense of, you wanted to do really well for her, was at least my sense. And when I would give her something, because back then, I mean, we're talking a long time ago, there wasn't track changes, right, on the computer. It was all like hand done. I would give her a bunch of stuff, like my theses, because you have to get your master's theses on the way to the dissertation. So I had that as a writing experience first. And she would send it back to me all marked up. And I'm like, oh, that's much better. And what finally occurred to me was that there aren't people who are just able to write well, and those who aren't. It takes work and it takes practice. And you just have to do it over and over again. And once I figured out that it's not that I don't have it, it's just that I need to work at it more, then it was like, okay, I can do this.
It's like working out. Physically and write alone. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. It just work at it more and don't expect that the first, because I think my thinking was, if I put it down on paper and it's bad, I'm just a bad writer. It wasn't that, you know, you need to keep doing it over and over and massaging it. And so that was, it just instilled in me that I'm able to do this. I just need to practice a lot more.
What was that master? Do you remember the master's thesis?
The master's thesis was on the Navajo Reservation too. So I went to the reservation and collected data for my master's, and it was just a really bad master's thesis. The way that I went about doing it, I was doing quantitative instead of qualitative, and that was just. So it was also on adolescent parenting on the Navajo Reservation, and then I went back for the dissertation and did a qualitative intergenerational study to really just improve on the shortcomings of the thesis.
Now, growing up in Durango, our diversity in Durango is Hispanic, Native American, and white. Mm-hmm. I did not really meet an African American until I went to Boulder.
Me either. Seriously.
But I did have relationships with Hispanics and Native Americans in high school. So you go from Boulder down to Tucson. Mm-hmm. Was your then look at the Navajo Reservation, was that purposeful?
Nothing I did.
Nothing you did.
So this is what happened. Again, just There was a lot of, I think, just divine intervention in my... There had to have been, because... So, I'm in Tucson. I'm done with my first year. It's time to really start thinking about a thesis, right, for the second year. And what happened is that there was an alternative school hooked to, connected to a high school on the Navajo Reservation. And they were having a difficult time getting these girls who were mothers, these adolescent girls who were mothers, to use their services. So they, because we were a Department of Human Development and Family Studies, there was this communication between the school, the teachers who ran this alternative high school, and my department, because it was a good fit, saying, you know, would anybody be interested in just coming up here and helping us understand what's going on? And so it was really an opportunity to go and to kind of help them out, right? And no one wanted to do it. And I'm like, oh, well, maybe I'll do this.
Well, because you're 22 years old.
I have no idea. Right. And I'm like, okay, well, I could do this, but maybe I could collect data for my thesis at the same time. That was it. I didn't even know I was interested in adolescent parenting until then. Is the That's the way it happened. And so I went there and stayed and collected data, did these.
So that was your summer between your first and second year of grad school.
When would that have been? It would have been, I know it was in the summer, and it probably would have been between my first, between my first and second year. And I went there, and I remember being on the phone, using a pay phone, calling Wendy, my advisor, and just, you know, telling her about these interviews and the data I was collecting, actually, you know, and yeah.
Did you like talking to people even before then? Because what you're talking about is, I mean, you're having to engage with people one-on-one.
Yeah. And for this part, it was really survey data. And so, and that's why it was not really appropriate, because the measures were just not for a Native population. No, I would say that I wasn't, honestly, Ted, I was not really that interested in engaging people. I wasn't good at it. So it all was a process.
2 years to your master's, mm-hmm. another three after that to the PhD. What was your, can you rattle off your PhD thesis title?
No. It's on the CV, though. It was adolescent parenting on the Navajo Reservation, something like, multiple perspectives within context. That's exactly what it was.
What's that mean?
It means that... I was really looking at this adolescent parenting with this particular population from the perspective of the teenage mothers, from the perspective of their mothers, so it was intergenerational, and then I also interviewed community members. So the teachers at the alternative school, I interviewed a nurse, I interviewed a Navajo medicine man. So I was really trying to look at this issue from multiple perspectives. And why it was really valuable is that at the time, and this actually continues to be the case today, is that adolescent parenting, and I don't know if you remember this or not, but back, 20 years ago, this was a huge, considered a social crisis, right? And people were really looking at blacks and Latinos and whites. No one was interested in what was happening on to Native
populations.
Right. But the rates of teenage parenting on reservations far exceeded what was happening in the white, Latino, and black populations. And so no one was looking at this. And so... the lens I was coming from. And it was like, I'm not looking at this as a social problem. I want to know from these different perspectives how they're viewing this.
What point do you then make the turn in your brain that you've become an academic?
That's a great question.
Because you just said that you had your aha moment coming back as you finalized your data gathering, and I can just see you driving down the highway and you're going, oh crap, I've got all this data. How am I going to turn it into 150, 180 pages of dissertation?
I will tell you exactly what happened. So I was leaving the reservation. I'm driving off of the Navajo reservation, and I'll tell you that a couple of things happened. Number one is that these, because when I went back for the dissertation, is that I was doing these interviews. I wasn't doing survey data. I was turning on a tape recorder and doing interviews. And I was asking people, these young girls, but also their mothers, about this really sort of crisis point in their lives, because these were not planned pregnancies. And all of these girls wanted lives where they went to school and had, you know, were able to make money and have lives that now were going to be really challenged by this, right? And they're sharing a lot of just really personal stuff with me. And some of them are crying, and mothers are crying. And when I'm leaving the reservation, it occurred to me that their heartaches was publishable, right? This was going to be good stuff. People are going to want to read this. And I now have a responsibility to them. And that's, I think, where the change in my brain happened, is that this is serious stuff. And this is people's lives. And their stories are opening doors for me. And I don't know that they're going to have doors opened for them, because it's their heartache that's going to make for people's interest in wanting to read it, if that makes sense. It was like I've been given gifts from these people that's going to give me my PhD and a position at a university, and I want to make sure that I do them justice, and I'm not just doing it for me anymore. I'm not just doing it for the PhD. Now I have a responsibility to them. And so I think that's sort of where a big change occurred in my brain, that I really want to proceed with integrity in how I go about presenting these very marginalized populations.
How was writing the dissertation? Did it come fairly easily to you? What do you remember about the pain of the dissertation?
It was really, really long. I don't remember. I just remember it was really, really long. I remember I wanted to. I did not want to. I didn't really want to cut. It was all really important, and I wanted all of these girls' voices to be heard and all of their mothers' voices to be heard. And I remember being very cognizant of the fact that I did not want them presented the way that people automatically, at least at the time, most people would automatically think of, you know, these teenage mothers who are on welfare. And I really just wanted to present their values and their resilience. I don't know how else to say that. But I also still struggled with the writing piece, because writing was still not my thing at the time. And so I still struggled with that, but. And I know by the time I got to the discussion, I was just burned out. I was just burned out and ready to be done.
Right. What, have you maintained any sort of follow-up with any of those folks?
That is such a phenomenal question, because when was this? In about 2007 about 2007. And this was really because of my mom. My mom was like, Rochelle, you need to go back and find out what happened to those women. You really need to go back and find out what happened to them. And I was really into a completely different line of research at the time. But I started thinking about it, and it's like, you know what, this actually might be possible. So yeah, I went back, and this has been published, and this is really, really phenomenal, because there's hardly any follow-up on adolescent mothers, and that does exist is really for a year or two later, not like 15 years later. And I went back to the reservation, and I was able to find about 71% of the original women that I interviewed again, and it was phenomenal.
What did you publish out for that?
I've published a couple of things. One of them is the title is something like adolescent parenting, you know, something like that. And then it's 15 years later. So that's one of them. And then the other one is called the Peter Pan syndrome. And it really, so one of them is just an overview of these women's lives, where they were 15 years later. So academically, jobs, families, that sort of thing. And then the other one was really about their relationships with men. And it's called the Peter Pan syndrome because one of the women that I interviewed, she had a quote that was so fabulous. What she said to me was, she's like, all the men here, she goes, they have the Peter Pan syndrome. None of them want to grow up. And that is the title then of another one that I published from them. And then I even published another one because the next summer I went back and collected data from the oldest child of a lot of those women. So looking at then these now teenage children of adolescent mothers and where they were academically and what they wanted for themselves long term. And yeah, so really just... I feel really good about that.
Has your work expanded beyond the Navajo Nation? Have you even been able to take that with some of the students you work with through the University of Nebraska? Has anybody done anything on like the Central Plains folks or Native tribes?
No, not that I know of.
No.
Actually, there is still so little written about... Actually, I don't want to say so little written about contemporary issues on reservations, but on adolescent parenting, anything like that on the reservations, very, very little written. And one thing that I think is important is that the tribes are all very different. And so what I found on the Navajo reservation might not generalize to others, right? But there's just it's really, really hard to do work on reservations because you need approval from tribal councils, and then you need buy-in. You really need gatekeepers to work with you. It's not easy work.
So you finish your dissertation, you uh-huh. get your PhD. Do you do any post-grad
Nothing.
Work?
Nope.
You just
applied for a few positions, and I had never set foot in Nebraska. I had never even driven through the state, never been to Nebraska. So I applied, I think, to 4 different places. And again, all kind of close to Colorado. And had very, very low expectations of Nebraska. And interviewed there and got the job. And I've been there ever since. And I love it. And I love the people I work with.
You don't, Rochelle, you don't get much more diverse going from Durango, Boulder, Tucson, Omaha.
Right.
I mean, those are 4 pretty different places.
They're all very different. They're very different. And I find just beauty in all of them. And, you know, I feel like I've, yeah. They're very, and politically very, politically,
culturally, I'm not even going to go down that way.
Geographically, yeah. They're all very, very different.
Yeah. That's a whole series of different podcasts right there. So at what point do you leave when do your academic focuses change? Are they almost immediately at Nebraska?
We'll talk about interventions here.
Yeah.
So I get to to UNL, and so I get to UNL, and the first thing is that I'm like brand new. I'm 26. I just turned 26. I've got this PhD. And I start by teaching 5 classes a year. And I'm like, really? I'm in charge of these? Are you kidding me? That was my first thought, is that someone's making a mistake here. But I start teaching, and it's an R1 institution. And so doing research is...
I mean, you're publish or perish.
You are publisher Parrish. That's exactly right. And I actually had a colleague, a friend of mine, give me this cartoon, and there's this guy standing in front of a firing squad, and at the bottom it says, it's publish or perish, and he didn't publish. And he's like, Rochelle, just keep your priorities in mind. And I'm thinking, okay, well, that's all fine and good, but I've got students that I face every day, and I need to be prepared for them. And so the first year was really just getting my classes in order. And to be honest with you, I was tired of adolescent pregnancy and adolescent sex, and I'm just like, I'm burned out. I need to do something different, right? I need to get away from that literature. But I had, this is 100% truly, I had no idea what it was going to be. I'm like, I don't know where my research is going to go. I just know it's not going to go down that path because I need something different. Again, just serendipity. I don't know what you'd call it. I was doing academic advising one time with a student in my office and just talking to her about not just, you know, classes, but what does she do, volunteer, this kind of stuff. And she tells me about a program in Omaha. I had no idea it existed. It was through the Salvation Army, and this program was specifically designed to help street-level prostituted women get out of the industry. Ted, the hair stood up on my arms. It was this reaction like, that's my next research. I just knew it. I'm like, tell me about this program. And I knew nothing about the sex industry or street level prost. I knew nothing. But I ended up going to the literature, of course, and looking at a little bit about what had been written. And lo and behold, nothing about these women's families. Nothing about their children. Nothing. Well, they've got to have kids. Why is no one looking at it from this angle? Why is no one looking at their families of origin or what they come from? People were really interested in needle sharing, risk taking. And I'm like, I'm really not interested in that. I'm interested in how they got there. How they got there and the family piece of it, right? I mean, that's the program I come from. That's what I'm trained in. And so that was my next, and I've basically been in that area ever since.
In terms of
my primary scholarship.
Now, your there's an academic portion of what you do, but is there a counsel? Did you have some counseling as well? And what was the purpose of that?
Yeah.
Tell me
question.
About that.
That's a great question. So, so let me back up. So I'm almost entirely a qualitative researcher. So I sit down with someone one-on-one and turn on a tape recorder and we have a conversation. I just happen to be asking them about their lives and some of the most horrific things that have happened to them, right? And through the course of doing this, it really occurred to me that I need to know more about, because these women that I'm interviewing have experienced extensive trauma, lots of trauma, and I wanted to know more about just mental health. I don't know if it was like treatment options and what does that look like? What does the training look like for people who are counselors, etc.? So I wanted to really just understand more about the treatment piece of it, so that I could maybe be a better researcher with the people that I was interviewing, the people that were my participants. And the fact is that as a professor at the university, I could take classes for virtually nothing. And I'm like, well, I might as well take advantage of this, right? So I started taking courses. So then I'd been a professor for, I don't know what, 10 years, and started taking courses, got accepted into a community counseling program, and just started taking courses, and then got a degree in counseling along the way. And I passed the tests, but I never did. I never went for licensure, because to do that, it would require like 1,000 hours. And
But it makes sense, because there is a part of you, when you're interviewing somebody, in order to get the best information from them, you have to move from being agnostic to sympathetic. And in order to do that, that does take some training and understanding mental health.
I think that, I think that that's 100% true. And I would say that I was, One of my strengths is that I was really interested in these women's lives and their heartaches and their pains. And that, I was really genuine. I still am really genuine in that. But I really just wanted to know more, too, about what could actually be done to help individuals who are in basically a constant state of crises. So mental health is one thing, but housing and legal assistance and their kids are in, and domestic violence, they've had so much going on, is what would be useful for them, right? So really from multiple perspectives, but the motivation to do this was really just to be better at my job.
Has your research then within the sex trade mostly focused in that upper Midwest area?
No.
Okay.
Great question. So I started, and it was really in Omaha, and I went into Iowa. I went into a maximum security prison in Iowa. So in the Midwest, I was interviewing women specifically who were working on the streets, not women who were in escort, anything like that. So really the lowest rung in terms of status in the sex industry. And then eventually my work has expanded internationally. I do a lot of work in India now, is the short answer to that question. So now I do a lot of work in India, and I've come back and I've got a project going in Nebraska again right now as well.
Because I know, I remember seeing, was it an HBO documentary or something? There was about human trafficking, the sex trade focused around the oil and gas exploration industry of the Dakotas and in Canada and in that. Have you spent any time working with those populations?
I've not spent any time doing that. So what happened? So I finished my data collection. And it took about 2 years or more to do these interviews, to get access to the populations, to do these interviews with these women, transcribe it all, publish, et cetera, doing a lot of that. And at the same time, I also started looking at immigrant Latinas who had moved into rural Nebraska to work in the meatpacking industry. So I kind of had two things going at the same time. Well, then I decided to go back and try and find the same women that I'd interviewed originally, right?
You got a lot of balls in the air.
Life course, right? And the whole thing is that what is going on right now is one snippet, and it's from a history that has occurred to you, and you also have a future. And a lot of it's based on the choices that you make and have made, and the opportunities are there. But all these women that I interviewed, they, for the most part, said, I don't want to do this anymore. Well, okay. Are you able to or are you able not? And what are the challenges to getting out of this? And so I went back and tried to find those same women again, not nearly as successful as I was on the reservation, but good stuff. And then there was a lot of work that had started happening with women involved in street level prostitution, a lot more being published. And let me back up and say that when I first started this, it was really the word trafficking was really not being used.
Well, it was being used when you think about it on an international level, but we don't think of it as being a U.S. or a domestic issue.
Right. It was not part of my thinking about what had happened to these women. I referred to them as prostituted women, understanding that something was being done to them, but I didn't have the right words for it yet. Then you go forward about 7, 8, 9 years, and this word trafficking is becoming more and more common in academia. And what does this mean? And the realization was like all of my women had been trafficked, or for the most part, right? I'd say about 80% of them had actually been trafficked. And the work that I do is with really hard to reach populations. And so when I first started doing work with these street level prostituted women, and especially doing these in-depth interviews, and I'm sitting down with them one-on-one and I'm asking them about their children and their lives, not about necessarily are they using needles or not, I wanted to know more then about what was happening in developing countries. So all of this, and really what happened is, this is the truth, is that they were hearing all of these stories about there were a lot of sensationalized, in my opinion, stories about trafficking and about people being, you know, stolen off the street and now they're working in this brothel or now they're chained up. And I'm like, who's doing this research? So now my researcher hat is on and I'm like, okay, I'm suspicious. I'm suspicious because I don't understand where the data is coming from and what is really happening. So that's then when my lens changed to, I want to know more about what's really going on behind these sensationalized, and again, in my opinion, really sensationalized stories of these victims. And so that's, I really then started, and it took a lot of work to put together, finding the NGOs, finding the gatekeepers, going to a different country to then collect data from trafficked women, women trafficked into the sex industry.
So are you talking about Americans that are, you're talking about internationals that are then trafficked into the United States? Or,
no.
Or you're saying even outside of the United
no,
States?
No, no. I went to India.
Okay.
No, my research right now is almost entirely focused in India. And
well, it's better food than Lincoln.
Awesome. I love the food. I love Indian food. That's right. I really like spicy. So, I ended up going to India. And the first time that I was there was in 2012. And for a number of reasons, India was selected. India is really just a lot of human rights violations in India and a lot written about sex trafficking in India. And I wanted to know, and again, I wanted to know life course. I wanted to know about these women's families, their children. I wanted to know how they ended up where they were. The other thing I wanted to know was, were they really trafficked? Now, this is important in terms of just, there is a really a lot of debate and a polarizing issue within academics and others as well is sex work trafficking or not? So if a woman is in the sex industry, is she trafficked? And there are people that will believe, there are people, experts, one side of this continuum that will say that any kind of sex work, you could really think of it as trafficking in some form or another. And then there's another side that says it's really possible to be involved in the sex industry without being trafficked. Now, I'm on... Go ahead.
All right. So real quick, I want to... We've used the term trafficked a bunch here.
Yes.
And I want to make sure that I understand what you're talking about. When you're talking about a human being that has been trafficked.
Right.
Turning it into a verb.
Right, right.
Are we talking about somebody that is no longer in control of their body, that somebody else has clamped chains around them and is in control of what they do on an hourly basis?
That's a great question, and this is why there is debate. Traffic, there are definitions, legal definitions. From the one that is most commonly used, just the short definition, is that trafficking is the result of force, fraud, or coercion. That's a very simplified way of saying it, force, fraud, or coercion. Or, and this is in the sex industry specifically, if you're younger than 18, then there doesn't have to be force, fraud, or coercion involved. You're just, because minors cannot make a decision to do this voluntarily. But then the issue is, well, to what extent is there force or to what extent is there coercion? And so there's gray area, and this is why there's debate. Okay? No, you don't have to have chains around you all the time, but you could still be considered a victim of trafficking. It gets complex, and it creates a lot of debate and a lot of differing views. So when I, and also what it does is part of a huge issue right now is that in terms of prevalence, no one knows prevalence. You, and this bothers me a lot, is that you will see numbers thrown about, 25 million people worldwide. This is a population that is really, really difficult to pin down in terms to access. And so there's a lot of suspicion, I don't know what the word would be, about the numbers. The numbers are hard to validate, okay? The numbers are not necessarily reliable. And so one of the things I wanted to do was have these women actually been trafficked based on force, fraud, or coercion, or have they entered the sex industry voluntarily? Is this, have they had personal agency in doing this? Parsing out the two. And when you don't do that, it really increases the prevalence. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Can I ask?
Anything, yeah.
Is there a point where trafficking makes the change to agency?
Absolutely. And then what? Right. So there can be, certainly, if someone has been, like, forced into the sex industry, a pimp, whatever, and now he's gone and she's just doing it on her own, how do you classify her? That's what makes this so hard. And then there are women, I've interviewed many women who then were recruiting other women. So now, and promising them things, and so now, are they a perpetrator, right? It's really gray. There are a lot of gray areas, which makes it complex, which makes the numbers in terms of prevalence. You just have to read more into what you're reading. And so this is what was going through my mind, right? So now I'm seeing about all these women, right, and these horrible stories being chained up, locked up, whatever. And I'm like, what's really going on here? Have they, first of all, have they been trafficked or not? And so that's why I went to India, was to...
Are there similarities between India and the United States in what you've been looking at?
There are, and actually I do have I have a chapter published looking specifically about the similarities and the differences between the street-level prostituted women that I was that I collected data from, and then the women in the brothels in Mumbai. And some of the similarities are really, I would say, childhoods of chaos, childhoods, family, family lives, families of origin that really were very chaotic, not a lot of opportunities, individuals having to sort of take responsibility for themselves very early on, violence, that sort of thing. Some of the differences were that the women in the States, by and large, well, one thing is that there are a lot more resources in the States for individuals. If they want to seek out services, there are a lot more services. That in the States, a lot of the women on the streets ended up, if they didn't have pretty serious drug addictions by the time they got there, they developed them. And that wasn't the case in...
That was my next question.
Yep.
Do drugs and alcohol, is that a difference between the two populations?
Very different. At least the women that I was interviewing in Mumbai, I mean, you don't really, first of all, these women are so poor that they don't have a lot of money to buy drugs. Alcohol is used. They would consider tobacco a drug. So tobacco and alcohol to some extent, but not the extent of what women were using. Crack cocaine was really what people were using. Now it's probably going to be more like meth, but I was interviewing the women in the States, long time ago. 18 years ago. But yeah, a lot more drugs here than there.
So...
By this population.
Right.
Yeah.
Your work now is mostly international?
My work now continues to be in India. And I'll tell you something. So again, a lot of work in the... So my work was in the brothels in Mumbai. I was working through an NGO and I interviewed women who were their entire lives now just working in these brothels. And they live in the brothels too, so their children live there with them. It's your question was, did my work there? It was. I think your question earlier was about the questions that I asked there. Did it inform what I do here? I'll tell you, when I went there, I went there thinking I'm going to kind of go from the same interview, like life course, with these women. And what I found is it would just It was really difficult there. And part of the issue with qualitative work specifically, when I sit down with someone one-on-one, and if we are able to speak the same language, right, all of that. I'm working through a third person who's doing the translation at the same time, and it's really hard to make the connection. So it was really, really hard to factor in the cultural differences, the language differences, and so it was really hard to make a real strong connection, at least initially, and I had to adjust for that. And I couldn't really, these women really didn't want to talk about their pasts and their families. Their families, the issue of shame in India was so much more pronounced and so much more a defining factor of their entire lives than it was here. And they, for the most part, didn't even have connections with their families anymore. And their families, many of them, had literally sold. I mean, sold them.
Just took the words right out of my mouth. How many of these women are in the position they're in because their families
had
used
them
as...
And some of them really young. I mean, 8, 9 years old, literally sold to a brothel. Some of them knew exactly how much they were sold for, and that was their lives. I talked to multiple women who had never gone back to their home villages, right? And so it was not, I mean, there are parallels, but there are a lot of differences too. And the whole family component, as a family scientist, that's where I'm keyed to. And I mean, there were some people who basically said, there's nothing to talk about my family growing up. You know, I mean, they just skipped right past it.
How's your Hindi?
You know, any kind of second language I would find useful. I speak nothing but English. I've got good translators, though. So then the work in 2012 really led me to a new area, and I'm really excited about this new area that I'm working on in India. In fact, I was there in January. And this is rural-based, trafficking, family-based. And they're, do you want to know that?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'll give you the long version, okay? So when I was doing the interviews among the women living in the brothels, a couple of them mentioned to me that they were Devadasi. And I'm like, I don't have any idea what Devadasi is. Well, so I started thinking, I want to study this. This is what I'm really interested in. And Devadasi is really, a family practice where young girls are dedicated to a goddess. And it goes back long before colonial time, where women would work in temples. And they were highly, highly respected because they did temple work. They basically were artists. They would dance, they would sing, etc. But they then also would be involved sexually with wealthy patrons or priests. Well, this then sort of fell to the wayside with the British coming over, all of that, blah, blah. So now this practice still continues, but has been pushed underground. So these are basically now girls who are still dedicated, but really it's dedicated prostitution. So they work, bring in money, support their entire families. They can never get married. They're married to the goddess. And families will dedicate daughters as Devadasi to ward off evil or to maybe help prevent illnesses, things like that. So I started looking into this, and I'm like, this is what I want to study. Well, it turns out there are people who have looked at this, and there's been work done. And in trying to find gatekeepers, people who could help me find populations to access for interviewing, someone said to me, well, Rochelle, there's other kinds. There's really family-based prostitution. It doesn't have to be Devadasi. I'm like, what are you talking about? Well, so I learned about... There are multiple castes in India that the primary source of income is through prostitution. And it's not Devadasi, which most people are Indians familiar with. This is this is known, this is common, but there are rural areas in India, men do not work. Men. And they haven't for generations. And we're talking really, really rural areas. And girls, young girls basically are either, they're really pushed into a path of marriage or pushed into a path of income generating. And income generating means they work in the sex industry. And beginning very early, when they're about 14, 15, about the time of menstruation, and their whole lives then is to be prostitutes. And this is in rural areas, and it's practiced in the family home throughout the day. So unlike in Mumbai, where you're working in a brothel at nighttime, this is now in a, and Mumbai is the biggest city in India. So that's not it. This is rural areas. You've got villagers, men from cities, from other villages coming into these communities because they are known for prostitution. And a woman would basically, in the family home, there would be a room where she goes, does her work, gets money. She supports entire family lineages until she ages out, until she's about 30, 40, can't really attract the clients anymore. New girls come in, are basically part of this system. They get involved in the industry, and then they stay in the industry, and then they support the women who have aged out, in addition to brothers and parents and grandparents. And this is now, and I just got back from India, and I was in 7 different villages, and I interviewed 31 of these women, basically from age 16 to 66. So those who've just gotten involved to those who got involved many years ago and then eventually aged out. It's absolutely fascinating, and especially from someone who's really interested in family dynamics. It is fascinating. And so you've got girls who they're involved, their sisters are involved. Some of them, they're the only one where all of their sisters are married and they're supporting sisters and sisters' husbands and sisters' children. You've got, you know, girls whose mothers or grandmothers or aunts were involved. It's, and this is, there is virtually nothing empirically known about these castes. So this is, and I just got back in January from this data collection. I was there 2 weeks, and it was like constant day. And so we would have to drive about 2 to 2.5 hours to get to the village, and we couldn't get there too early because people would still be sleeping. I mean, they work all day, right? So people would still be sleeping, and then we'd have to leave early afternoon because clients would start showing up. So, you know, there was one day that we interviewed like 1 or 2 people, and then some days where you just go. And I was able to interview, I think I had 2 days where I was able to interview 7 people, which was just really amazing. And like I said, 7 different villages, and just really hard work, hard stories, difficult stories. No one's lives were good. None of these women.
That's a heck of a way to take your sabbatical.
Well, yeah. I mean, you have to have something on sabbatical, right? You have to have something. The other thing that I'm doing right now, because I've also decided I really need to know more about what's happening in my state, in Nebraska. And again, getting back to this issue of trafficking or not, there's a lot. And I just got really disgusted, to be honest with you, with stuff that I was seeing in Nebraska about all individuals involved in the sex industry being clumped together as being trafficked. And I'm like, wow. So now I got disgusted by it because it's not correct, in my opinion. It's not accurate. And
so then you're going to have a little bit of a battle, I think, because you're taking a look at this from an academic point of view, and then maybe you have legal issues that are going to be at play here, because the legal definition of traffic may be something that's different than the academic view that you're taking.
My view is the same as the legal view. And
alrighty.
That's force, fraud, coercion.
Got
so
it.
I'm going based, and this is from the United States government. Okay. So yep. The Trafficking Victim Protection Act, that's the definition I use, but there are individuals, others, who believe that any kind of, because it's exploitative, it can be exploitative because women are in situations where their body bodies are being used by others. And I'm focused on women specifically, but that is not at all to discount the tremendous amount, the growing issue of and recognition of men being forced into the industry either, okay? Right. Mine just happens to be on women. I really just want to get more at the legal side and not clumping it all together. So using that definition to look at what's happening in the state of Nebraska. And so now, right now, I'm involved in a study trying to get at the extent of labor. So not just sex trafficking either, but labor and sex trafficking using the actual formal definition for trafficking, force, fraud, coercion. So I have both of these projects going at once right now.
And yeah. How many? Well, it's a good thing you're on sabbatical right,
right
now.
Right,
right. You wouldn't have time to teach anything.
No. Well, okay, and that's what sabbatical is, right? You have to have a project. There has to be a reason to do it. And the way that mine came about is I was so burned out, Ted, in terms of teaching. I was just so burned out. And I just, and so I really needed to get a break from teaching. And I love the research piece. And so I really combined it. I'm doing this. And I happen to also have two grants, one to support the work in India and one to support the work in Nebraska. And I'm like, okay, now's the time. I'm doing sabbatical. So to do those specifically, but also to give me the opportunity to just not teach and, like I'm doing now, go to visit family when I want.
And we'll wrap this up. You're dealing with something that is so emotionally intensive.
Oh, my God. Really?
What are you doing for your own mental health?
You know, I will tell you that when I left India the first time in 2012, I swore I would never go back. I'm like, I am never coming back here. There's just so much heartache here. And then I've been back like 8 times, right? This trip was really hard too, really hard. And I was basically having an existential breakdown on the plane coming back. It was like, what good is, and I think probably a lot of people go through this at times. I don't know what a lot of people do or not, but I'm just assuming it's not just me. But I'm like, what? How am I really benefiting these women, right? How am I, is this work? So I'm going to bring awareness to this, and I'm going to maybe down the road at some point, but it's really hard to try and, I was having just a hard time on the plane about what value is this going to be to these women's lives, because they're not going to change. And
at the end of the day, we want to make sure that we're making, that we want to have an impact on the greater world around us.
Right.
And it's not to say that those people, that these women in India are any less important than
okay
us here.
Right.
What can little old me do
right
about what's going on over there?
Right.
What can little old me do about trafficking in the sex trade here in Colorado?
Right. So, well, let me get back to your other question, yeah, which was, what do I do for my own mental health? Maybe you're assuming I'm mentally healthy.
I know, it's your fifth cup of coffee since we've been sitting here. No, I'm not.
So I don't know. I definitely do. Like, I think the one main thing that I do is I just try and believe. I try and, again, getting back to that realization, driving off the reservation. I want to tell these women's stories with integrity. I want to do them justice. I want to feel like I'm being really genuine to what's happening to them in the way that this is presented academically. I also, on a personal note, am working with an NGO to try and do an entrepreneurial business, try and get an entrepreneurial business started, so that aside from my academic professional life, on a personal side, financially, exploring some ways to create some industry in these very rural areas for these women to have options other than this. I feel pretty good about that. So those are the main things. And then really just family and having a 7-year-old really makes you live in the moment, right?
So you've got some writing to do the rest of this semester.
I've got a lot of writing to do. I've got, I'm going to be presenting this work at many conferences this year. Yeah.
And then you're back in the classroom in August.
I'm back in the class. I'm a 12-month faculty, so I teach in the summer too.
Oh, okay.
So I'm, yeah, back in the classroom in May.
In May.
Yeah, in May.
What, is this what you see doing for the long haul?
Yeah. Well, as you probably know, I'm not like a long-term writer, but I love the research piece of it. And I hope by the time I start teaching again that I get back to loving the teaching, because a lot of experiences with student cheating and academic dishonesty, and it was really weighing on me. And when I'm just doing it to be done with the class, I'm not doing anyone any good. So I hope that passion, that love for teaching comes back too.
How about some of your graduate students? Have you been able to push them in the direction of this human trafficking? And are you able to get other people engaged in this issue as well?
So I work with some phenomenal doctoral students right now. And so what happens is that student, like, I don't push my students into anything. Really, when students now are applying to our graduate programs and our doctoral program in particular, they have to identify faculty that they want to work with. And so students will identify me because of my work. So they already have an interest in that. But I'll tell you, if a student's interests change along the way, I don't take that personally. I have two students right now who are doing really, they're doing just cool things, because one of them, what her dissertation will be on is the children of strippers. So women who've worked in nightclub stripping and then engaged in possibly some sex work on the side. So she's looking at their children, which has not been done before, right? And another student who is looking at the children in India. So she's Indian, and she's looking at the children of trafficked women and basically parenting practices. And so offshoots from what I'm doing, but really just cool stuff that is valuable, that will be valuable in the literature.
What else were you going to say?
I was going to say that with our new batch of students coming in, two students coming in have identified me that they're really interested in trafficking and that sort of thing. And so I will work with them. And if they decide to stay in this area, I'll help them. And if their interests lead them elsewhere, that's okay too.
Okay. Last thing. Tell me about the journal that you edit.
Oh my gosh. The journal, Journal of Human Trafficking. So, the first issue, inaugural issue, was in, March of 2015. So it's pretty new journal. It's published by Taylor and Francis. We publish 4 issues a year. This is academic. This is empirical stuff. Basically, I'll tell you how this all came about is that really, I've got some phenomenal colleagues here in the United States, and there's a group of us, and we were talking about putting together a journal on sex, on prostitution and sex work. And my thinking is that that's been done, and I don't know that that's really the direction we want to go, da-da-da. And then I was thinking about, where am I going to publish my stuff from Mumbai? So in 2012, I'm like, where am I going to publish this stuff on trafficking that people are going to have access to? And there really wasn't a journal on trafficking specifically, so that's really where the seed hit. So then I started submitting proposals for brand-new journals, right, to Sage, to Taylor and Francis, to some of the big publishing houses, and lo and behold, Taylor and Francis just decided, yeah, they wanted to do it, and I love it. So I'm right now the editor-in-chief. Donna Sabella at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, a really good colleague of mine. She's an associate editor. I've got an associate editor in India. I've got another one.
It's an international.
So a couple of things about this journal that make it really phenomenal. Number one is that we're not just interested in sex trafficking, labor trafficking, organ harvesting, anything, right? We're interested in any kind of trafficking. We don't limit it. We're interested in trafficking all over the globe. This is a global issue. If you've got a study in Madagascar, and actually I have one published in there from Madagascar, send it to me. That's the second thing that's cool about it. The third thing is that this is a multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary. So it's not like it's focused on sociologists or anthropologists. We've got people from the medical field publishing in our journal. We've got lawyers. We've got people from anthropology. So completely interdisciplinary. And that's what trafficking is. It's global. It affects every discipline to some extent. Economics, right? The tourism industry, geography. So it's completely interdisciplinary, international, and any kind of trafficking, as long as it's methodologically sound, as long as it's scientific and you're contributing something new. And it's also double-blind reviewed. So we go through, you know, that whole double-blind review process. But you've got a chance to be published in it. And I love it. And I hear great stuff about it all the time. I'm working with really good people. And what I love is filling a need in the academic world for this, because it really didn't exist before.
Thank you very much, Rochelle.
You're
this
welcome.
Was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun.
Safe travels today as you head back home.
All right. Thank you so
Thanks.
Much.
Rochelle Della, I just can't thank you enough for taking 90 minutes out of your day on that Sunday before you drove back home to see your family. Thank you so much, and I look forward to checking in with you again and catching up. I think your journey is something else. All right, Piled High and Deep, the podcast, we're back. I've got more interviews lined up. And hopefully I'm going to get back on this every other Wednesday schedule to get a new podcast episode up and for you. As always, appreciate any comments that you want to leave on whatever podcast delivery system you're using, iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, etc. Also, shoot me an idea via the website, themountaingeek.net, or via Twitter, at the Mountain Geek. You've given me an hour and 26 minutes of your life. Thank you very much. It's greatly appreciated. And come on back in a couple of weeks. I'll have another episode for you. Until then, keep shoveling.